I think a lot of the time it's really about why are you taking venture funding, right? And really understanding, you know, what we're thinking. Because I think in general, equity from venture capital is very expensive. Do you really want to get involved with the VC fund? And really, it's a pressure cooker. You know, I don't think it's for everyone, because you can build a lifestyle business, or you can build a business that's bootstrapped and it grows at a moderate pace, rather than like, we're looking for aggressive growth. We're looking for, you know, testing product market. We're really looking for market expansion. You know, that kind of lifestyle is not for everyone.
This is Startup Island Taiwan. Everything about Taiwan and cutting-edge technology, startup unicorns, and connections to the world.
Welcome to the Startup Island Taiwan podcast. My name is John from Asian Armory. I'm your guest host for today. And I'm here with Kathy Huang, venture partner at Palm Drive Capital. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jonathan. Big fan of yours. First time caller, long time listener.
Kathy and I, we actually go way back. So it's kind of fun to sit in front of you in a more formal setting.
It's a bit strange, but, you know, especially minus, you know, we usually meet each other at dinners and poker tables. And so this is a very formal setup, I must say.
Yeah. We're missing an extravagant duck dinner or lunch or something else. So, you know, we've talked a lot, and actually the funny thing is that I actually know very little about your firm and like what you do at work and kind of what your tasks are. Can you give me an overview and a little insight about Palm Drive Capital, especially regards to the Taiwan market?
Sure. Happy to. So I'm a venture partner at Palm Drive. I joined the firm in 2020, and it is an early stage venture capital firm based out in New York City. It was started by two managing partners who met at Stanford in 2014. And so through kind of, you know, almost 10 years of history, we've raised three funds to date and roughly managing about $400 million in assets across three active funds. We're in the process of raising our fund number four. In terms of our involvement in Taiwan, we've been active in Taiwan since 2019 and have made about eight investments early stage. So for us, definition of early stage is, you know, anywhere from Series A, Series B to pre-A seed stage. We sort of invest across this spectrum. And my role, you know, is really to help originate opportunities from Taiwan. Our goal is to find startups here that have the ambition to scale their operations globally. So that's our mandate, and that's what we, you know, are working on.
On a day-to-day basis, what does that kind of work look like? Do you spend a lot of time looking at newspaper articles or like jumping conferences? Like, what is that like kind of day-to-day?
So from a day-to-day perspective, we meet with a lot of founders and we meet with folks in the ecosystem. So generally, like our role is divided into kind of three parts. There is the sourcing of opportunities, and there is the qualifying of, you know, investments that we're actually going to make. So that involves doing due diligence, really understanding, you know, what the outlook of the firm, what we think of, you know, in terms of longer term trajectory, what would the outcomes be? And then we also make sure once we're invested in the company, we're partners with the founders, we provide portfolio support. So that's kind of the general mental model of, you know, what a VC does kind of on a day to day. So it could, you know, involve anywhere from meeting up with new founders that we've never met before, looking at, you know, doing due diligence on opportunities, talking, you know, prospective customers, and anywhere from helping our startup founders recruit talent. If they're looking to fundraise elsewhere, sometimes we, you know, chime in on their pitch deck. So it can run the gamut. There is no kind of what a normal day is. It's sometimes we're a little bit reactive, but usually these are the three activities that fill the calendar.
What's kind of like the profile of a startup? You mentioned you made like eight investments, right? In Taiwan market, what are sort of the profile of these companies? Like, what is it about them that jump out at you that really get you wanting to invest?
I think where we differentiate a little bit from other local venture funds that you see in Taiwan is that we typically would like to see a little bit of traction. So I think in Taiwan, where we've done, you know, both government as well as early stage ecosystem have done a very good job at is really at the formation stage. There are subsidy programs, there are, you know, angel funding that help founders, you know, to go from inception to maybe figuring out product market. Not necessarily figuring out sales motion or the entire go-to-market playbook to justify kind of longer term unit economics. So typically for us, I think, you know, the opportunities that we look at aren't necessarily super early. They probably have built some kind of product or in the process of building products. And for us, the criteria typically would have to be the founder can scale the operations outside of Taiwan. So early traction in other markets like Japan, Southeast Asia, you know, we have some founders that target the US market. That's helpful because that's where we can come in and play a more kind of pivotal role other than just bringing the capital to the table.
Do you find these founders are like more international, or do you find a lot of them are maybe younger, a lot more energy, a lot more outgoing kind of thing?
Through kind of my experience interacting with founders over the last, you know, 10 plus years, I don't think there is a stereotype or like a standard sort of on paper resume that you look for. I think it's really dependent on the founder's kind of ability, grit, and the ability to be resourceful.
Their insanity.
Yes.
To start a company.
Yes. And that's in Taiwan, like if you're willing to take that initial step, you're already an outlier, right? So sometimes, you know, we'll look for what we call a haigui, right? So they either have studied abroad, worked abroad, and then maybe they have some experiences working in Taiwan, or, you know, they've worked at larger kind of FANG companies. Those are all very helpful experiences, but not, you know, these are, I would say, like not necessary conditions, but they're, you know, helpful for, you know, for founders to have this type of experience. Some of them are repeat founders. Some of them have family businesses that they saw like a need and then they decide to start something on their own. So it really depends. But I think the characteristics that you typically look for is, you know, someone who will stick it through in the thick and thin and have that ability to really be persistent.
Do you feel like the startups that you look at often, not necessarily invest in, are they more web startups or kind of like more hardware product startups, like making manufacturing things kind of thing?
In terms of what Palm Drive looks at from an investment lens, we tend to focus a little bit more on the B2B businesses. And this is not just because, you know, the market size of Taiwan being smaller. I think like even in the US, about 70% of our portfolio companies are more B2B facing. So that probably means software for us. We have looked at some hardware enabled companies, but typically there needs to be some kind of software story that would pique our interest a little bit more. I think in Taiwan, we have mostly done B2B as well, just because, you know, the marginal kind of cost of finding new customers in software businesses is a lot more scalable. You know, building a semiconductor fab costs $10 billion. And so it's definitely beyond kind of the venture game that we're in.
I've heard that in Taiwan, like enterprise B2B companies, especially in the software space, have a lot harder time getting traction with those companies, maybe because a lot of them are old-fashioned. There's some of the laws, I guess, maybe are a little more paper-oriented. Have you seen sort of that effect? Is that kind of something that you notice with B2B startups in Taiwan?
I think what we've noticed is that if you build a product for a Taiwanese enterprise client in mind, typically, that sales motion is not necessarily, you know, repeatable outside of Taiwan. So I think, you know, when it comes to enterprise and when it comes to, you know, building solutions for Taiwanese corporate audience that have the budgets, so mainly in manufacturing and financial services, these are probably the two sectors, and maybe thirdly retail. But when it comes to manufacturing and financial services, at least, you know, in the last 20 years or so, the primary focus really has been around cost reduction. So, you know, with our labor costs being on the cheaper end of the spectrum, a lot of the times it's not the easiest task for founders to sell into these verticals. I think in financial services, we're starting to see some changes because of competition, right? Like online bank, like Line, you have Rakuten that all have digital banking licenses. That's really instilling some innovation, the inspiration to innovate for some of these corporates that might have just sort of, you know, sat kind of comfortably in their position. On the manufacturing side, I think we're seeing that sort of shift, paradigm shift as well, you know, with labor shortages, with now, you know, we have ever more kind of powerful chipsets. How do we be more efficient through technology, through either artificial intelligence, through data, through, you know, automation, and reduce kind of the, you know, labor involvement? I think on that side of the equation, we're also seeing some changes there. But in the past, I think when we see B2B software companies, when they go to market here, I think those are some of the challenges that, you know, companies aren't necessarily that interested in buying software.
I was wondering how long we could go before AI would come up. How's Taiwan taking advantage of or involved in with kind of like this generative AI trend? I heard it was a big deal in America.
I would agree with that statement. one would almost argue that it's a little bit overheated. So in terms of our internal thesis of how we look at AI, I think there are three sort of layers. One is at the compute hardware level. And I think Taiwan is well positioned to capture. We have some large corporates that have sort of positioned early, and they're well positioned to be able to leverage the tailwind to sell more of their hardware products. Again, personally, I think it's tough for early stage venture to play because it's hardware. It's a lot of initial capital to get that going. The middle layer for us, it's really around the model layer, so LLMs. And there's a lot going on there now, especially I think you see some of the larger venture funds really throwing a lot of money. And then you see Amazon, Microsoft, and Google all sort of building up their strategic alliances with the different LLMs. And that makes sense because, you know, at the compute level, they're really trying to sell more of their cloud solutions. And being aligned there, I think, has strategic value for them in the long term. And at this stage of the game, we think a lot of value capture will most likely happen at that layer for some of these big tech names. And then at the application, which is the last layer where we're seeing, you know, with ChatGPT, you know, Midjourney, some of these, you know, 2C solutions, I think some of our enterprise application software founders are now increasingly trying to be able to leverage these tools for their end customers to be able to utilize. And right now, I think it's early. I think no kind of enterprise software solution companies or even, you know, vertical SaaS companies, they're launching these solutions without, you know, extensive testing. Right. So give you a practical example. One of our companies that provide a chat solution to retail customers. One of the problems when they test the ChatGPT-like solution is the brand itself wouldn't want the chat engine to recommend a competitive product. Right. So how do you kind of address that problem? Or do you recommend, you know, competitive product and be okay with that? So these are some nuances, but I think longer term for application software companies, I think where they have a significant moat is really their go-to-market and their ability to convey their value proposition most clearly. So I think OpenAI, no idea what their longer term goals are, but, you know, it would shock me if their goal is to build, you know, a ton of end customer relationships, right? I think they want to provide the picks and shovels to power the AI engine, but not necessarily sell that product to the end customer, because then they would have to build the go-to-market sales motion, which would not really make sense, in my opinion.
Do you think like founders in Taiwan are a bit not sure what to do with it, especially with regards to like the example you mentioned, like they feel uncomfortable with the fact that it's not controllable, I guess, like it might go off the rails and do something crazy like that?
So to take a different perspective, I actually think founders really should think about, you know, how do you use these tools to make your own workforce more efficient? How do you streamline the things that maybe you wanted to streamline in the past but haven't been able to? I think the ability to really understand what these tools do and then be able to build on it is a good first step to get familiar with kind of what the capabilities are, right? And in terms of actually generating revenue off of ChatGPT and the likes, I think, like, kudos if you can figure that out today. But I think the familiarity with what's available in the market today is probably a good first step.
Do you find that when you go to your companies, or not even your companies, but other companies, do they ask you questions like these? Are they curious about what other people are doing in their industry? Or do you find more like they're asking questions about how to improve the product, or how to make their product better, or how to find new customers? Like, what do you usually get kind of questions you get on a day-to-day basis?
I think most founders are interested to know what are some of the successful deployment of actual AI products today, and what does that product look like? I think that's where we get asked the most. There are some founders where I would be a little bit more worried about, hey, you know, is your product going to be viable longer term? Like, how would AI kind of disrupt your end market away, or is that a possibility? And that is definitely something I hope that most founders will keep that in mind, because what works today doesn't necessarily mean, you know, what it'll continue to work, especially now with AI. I think it's quite possible that, you know, certain end markets will disappear, right? So for instance, to consumer, like, we're seeing a lot of opportunities that touching consumer directly. So whether it's in healthcare or in travel, right? You know, we've had heard stories about how ChatGPT is diagnosing patients, or, you know, anyone with certain symptoms, they can go on to ChatGPT. And that's one use case. And I think, you know, it's certainly interesting, especially if you have imagination on how this product can work longer term. On the travel side, you know, I think with the younger demographics today, we care more about travel experiences. We're not necessarily looking to, you know, number one, optimize cost, and number two, optimize every possible kind of sightseeing location, right? We're looking for unique experiences. Like, for instance, you and I, when we enjoy good meals, so when we go to a new destination, how about let's find interesting Michelin restaurants, or chefs that are, you know, that are passionate about locally grown vegetables or dairy? And how can AI or a new type of travel agent to be able to help you build an itinerary in a much more efficient and faster way than in the past, where we tend to have an intent in mind, right? Now, you know, I can just enter into a search query and say, like, hey, build me an itinerary for Venice and Florence for 2 weeks. And it would then generate and then be able to help you book flights, help you, you know, book lodging and restaurants and sort of other interesting destinations. So these are some of the imagination of, I think, what can be achievable. And we are seeing, you know, some startups now working toward this.
You know, having seen kind of the Taiwan tech startup economy, I guess, for the past so-and-so years, how has it changed? Because when I first came here in 2016, it was like nothing. It's like random nothing stuff. How have you seen it kind of change over the past couple of years since then?
So I moved back also in 2016, and I definitely feel like the last 5-7 years, we've seen very positive growth. I think whether it's more accelerators, more angels, more VC, in all sort of categories of growth, we have been able to really see visible steps in the right direction. Post-COVID, we've definitely seen more activities in Taiwan, whether it's because folks are interested in no quarantine life in Taiwan from the US or anywhere else. You know, generally, I think we will all agree that Taiwan is very safe. It's very clean. We have a public infrastructure that works very well. We have healthcare that's very affordable, even out of pocket. So there are certain, you know, qualities of life factors that bring talent to Taiwan. How can we, you know, synthesize that trend and then, you know, couple with what's available here to build a sustainable ecosystem that can grow? I think that's a longer term kind of vision that's probably beyond my pay grade today. My interest and the goal that, you know, we have at Palm Drive is really to help foster the next generations of not just unicorns, but like 10x unicorns that are large enough to really be able to pay back to the ecosystem. Right now, I think we have large successes, whether it's an Apier or 9-1 APP or Gogoro. I think these are good sort of steps in the right direction. But when you look at kind of per capita GDP, when it comes to Taiwan, when it comes to, you know, producing the number of unicorns, we're really punching below our weight level. And I think, you know, that is not really a judgment on, you know, the ecosystem itself. I think we have one industry that resulted in like a 100x unicorn, right? Like that's the semiconductor industry. And it's produced so many great companies, whether it's in, you know, semiconductor or ICT itself. But as we kind of look forward, how do we create more, right? That's using venture money rather than, you know, rather than corporates, you know, reinvesting their own profits and create new category of winners. So that's really kind of our, you know, our mission and the work that we like to help early stage founders accomplish here.
What do you think are the circumstances that can help create like a 10x? Does it need to be the size of a Facebook? Does it need to be the size of a Google or something like that? Because those companies are pretty rare. So is that has to be the case or can it be something else?
So the companies that you reference, right? I think they're over 100 billion in valuation when they went public, right? So Meta is now, I don't know the market cap, but probably close to a trillion. Google is more than a trillion. Microsoft is 3 trillion. So these are very lofty outcomes, but I think when you have like a $100 billion outcome, so owning 1% of that business is 1 billion, right? And in that instance, you are more than well equipped. You're like more than set financially, probably several generations over, right? So then you would be able to kind of give back to the community and say, hey, like, you know, be able to write checks. So in Silicon Valley, we do see these types of super angels where it's a one-man fund and then they're on a mission to maybe it's about AGI, maybe it's about healthcare, maybe it's about something else, to really be able to fund those types of efforts as a single individual. And I think for Taiwan, if we can create a company that's like a 10x unicorn or a decacorn, the outcomes that are big enough where early employees, early investors sort of can be able to have that type of financial reward to be able to give back to the community. That, I think, would help us sustain, sort of create that flywheel and be able to sustain our ecosystem for the longer term. Rather than, you know, sometimes I think we see kind of the fits and starts of, you know, government trying to renew certain, you know, subsidy programs or, you know, tax incentives, et cetera. I think those are all fantastic and they're all very important. But to really have kind of a self-sustaining flywheel that can get bigger and bigger over time, my belief is that, you know, the movie of creating these really large outcomes is very important.
What have you been seeing as kind of like the strengths of Taiwanese startups so far, like as compared to maybe outside of other regions within the portfolio? Like, what do you kind of admire about them and what do you find like really strong?
My experience with founders that are based in Taiwan is I think they are very practical. And that is one thing, I think, given where the macro situation with venture is now, which is not as good, we really see the founders here adjust very quickly and adjust their expectations. I think it also allows them to be more practical and flexible when it comes to fundraising. So I think in the US, even up to the end of or the middle of 2023, we have founders that are interested in fundraising. They haven't really cut burn or they, you know, they have a vision of like, I'm going to raise a very clean Series A or Series B round. But the market has turned aggressively at that point in time. And if you kind of are on that path, you are definitely in for a rude awakening. And we've seen that with some startups. And in Taiwan, I think our founders are more sensitive to macro, and I think they are able to adjust much more quickly when it comes to whether it's just cutting burn or right-sizing headcount, and adjust kind of their sales expectations. I think that that is something I think founders here tend to have a clearer view on, you know, than founders that are based in the US, as an example.
What are some things you feel like that founders that want to start a company and want to do VC, like VC funded stuff, like what do they need to know and what do they need to learn?
I think a lot of the time it's really about why are you taking venture funding, right? And really understanding, you know, what we're thinking. Because I think in general, equity from venture capital is very expensive. Do you really want to get involved with the VC fund? And really, it's a pressure cooker. You know, I don't think it's for everyone because you can build a lifestyle business or you can build a business that's bootstrapped and it grows at a moderate pace rather than like we're looking for aggressive growth. We're looking for, you know, testing product market. We're really looking for market expansion. You know, that kind of lifestyle is not for everyone. And to really understand, you know, what does the VC bring to the table is very important. So I'll give you an example. One of our portfolio founder, Trenton, he's the founder of GoFreight. When we met, I think he was very proud of the fact that like the company is break even and they have moderate growth. You know, they're adding a couple of customers a year, but it wasn't kind of explosive, the type of venture backable growth that, you know, the likes of us are looking for, right? And a big kind of, you know, point of contention, even with his own founders, is like, hey, you know, we're comfortable. Like, you know, we have three founders, you know, we have a team of 10 folks, we take home a good salary. We can do this for a long time without having any issues or considerations of raising external capital. So that is a discussion that founders sort of need to have amongst themselves on, does it make sense? Like, do I really want to, you know, to have that external capital come in and then we're on a different type of trajectory for growth? And again, it's not for everyone. I think, you know, the end goals are quite different, right? And what does your VC bring to the table, I think, is very important. It's not just about capital at the end of the day. Because, you know, again, like if it's really just about that, then you are able to raise from, you know, a lot of, you know, there are a lot of resources out there, even like bank financing, et cetera, right? So having that kind of vision of growth and then doing something big, you know, is very important. It is something that we look for in founders.
What is like your pitch then? Going back to that example, like the co-founders are living a nice life or something, like what was that pitch you say? It had to be more than just capital, right? Like what sort of decision or what do you feel like that sort of thing that has to be said? Like what is that other upside that really changes that business? And like why would people ever want to do it?
Yeah. In the case of GoFreight, I think it was just a realization that, oh, wow, this is a blue ocean market today. There is not a ton of cloud native solutions that's servicing freight forwarders. And how is the team, is the management team interested in scaling into a big kind of vertical SaaS player in that? I think that takes a lot of communication with the founders, as well as, you know, us doing the work and believing that this will be a very, very large opportunity and that we can help support the team to get to that end destination.
So what does the future hold for Palm Drive Capital? Like, what's ahead? Like, what are you excited about going forward?
I think for us, the goal really, you know, we have a small team here. We're not the biggest fund that's, you know, from the US is based out here. Our goal really is trying to be consistent and diligent in finding, discovering new founders, maintaining kind of close touch with existing founders in our network and help founders that are interested to go abroad. I really view kind of our mission in three different buckets. As a VC based in Taiwan, our goal is really help startups bridge to capital in the US specifically. We think that Western capital can really help amplify many, many different activities, whether it's go to market or recruiting. So talent is a big part. And then the second bucket really is around recruiting. So looking for top tier talent that's either interested, you know, from the Bay Area, we're seeing some of that, but not enough to kind of make it a trend. But I think some talent, especially if they have roots in Taiwan, they're interested in coming back. And, you know, a lot of the times we hear, oh, we're not able to find good jobs here. So how do we entice them, whether it's compensation or quality of life, lifestyle factors, to kind of entice them to stay? And then the third really is around kind of market expansion, whether it's to Japan, Southeast Asia, even the US. You know, we're day-to-day involved with a lot of different corporate partners, whether it's in retail, manufacturing. We have a lot of relationships locally as well. How do we kind of explore the possibility of partnerships for our founders when they go to a new geography? So, you know, these are the three kind of buckets that where we provide value prop to founders in the network. And, you know, you don't have to be a Palm Drive invested company for us to want to be able to be helpful. I think in general, because our community is still a manageable size. So a lot of the times, if we can, you know, be helpful to you, you know, you're always welcome to reach out to me. You know, we view founders as very special people, and to the extent like we want the overall ecosystem to be successful, because if it is, you know, I think rising tide lifts all boats will, you know, either directly or indirectly benefit as well.
Kathy, Palm Drive Capital, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, John.